The Catra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Catra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are diving into the American landscape of the 1960s, a really fractured time, through the eyes of one of his sharpest observers, Joan Didion. We're looking at her 1968 collection, Slouching Towards Bethlehem.
Yeah, and it's easy to just think, oh, hippie, summer of love, you know. But Didion was doing something much deeper. It felt like she was performing, well, almost surgery on American culture.
Surgery? How so?
Looking at what happens when all the old rules, the traditional ways of structuring society and morality just crumble. Not just bend, but break down completely. A kind of cultural collapse.
And that feels incredibly relevant now, doesn't it? This idea of shared values disappearing, institutions maybe not holding up. If you feel like things are atomized today, like we can't agree on basic facts, Didion saw that starting. She absolutely did. Mm-hmm. She was asking this question that still resonates, I think, for you listening. What actually happens when the stories we tell ourselves to make sense of life just evaporate? When that whole idea of a center goes missing?
People are left adrift, right? Trying to navigate without a map.
Exactly. Yeah. And she documented the huge psychological cost of that. That feeling of being unmoored.
Okay, so let's talk about the writer herself. Joan Didion, 1934 to 2021, a pioneer of new journalism.
Right, and that's important. New journalism wasn't just about facts. It used literary tools, storytelling, character, internal thoughts, really specific details to get at the experience, the feeling, the meaning behind events.
And her prose style is famous for that precision. Cool, detached, almost clinical sometimes.
Yeah, like surgical steel, people have said. But behind that coolness, there's this intense sensitivity. And her background is fascinating, too. She wasn't just observing California. She was California, fifth generation.
So she had this almost instinctual grasp of the myths, the big golden land promise.
And the messy, often disappointing reality underneath it all. Plus, her early job at Vogue.
Right, the fashion magazine.
Yeah, it trained her eye. Fashion is all about decoding subtle shifts, what's really going on beneath the surface image. She learned to see the gap between what people claimed and how they actually lived.
So she could navigate between, say, a fancy Hollywood party and a commune in Haight-Ashbury.
Exactly. Kind of an insider and outsider at the same time.
Yeah.
She understood the dreams, but saw the fallout.
Which brings us to the book's title and main idea taken from that W.B. Yeats poem, The Center Was Not Holding.
Mm-hmm. The Second Coming. Yeats's poem is dark, apocalyptic anarchy loosed upon the world, the old order collapsing.
Yeah.
Didion looked at America in the 60s and saw that poem playing out in real time.
But the book isn't proposing solutions, is it? It's more like a diagnosis.
Precisely. A diagnostic portrait of a society in crisis. She's showing you the symptoms, vividly, but not writing a prescription.
And it moves from the big picture, the cultural movements, down to the individual level.
Yeah, you see that arc. From the counterculture and politics down to the personal psychological effects of living through that kind of chaos.
The structure reflects that. You mentioned three parts.
Right. Lifestyles and the Golden Land focuses on California, the epicenter of some of this breakdown. Then personals, where she gets more reflective, talks about identity.
Okay.
And the third is Seven Places of the Mind. That one explores how places, memories, and myths kind of define us, but also how they can mislead us. It really maps out that fragmentation.
Let's get into some specifics then. That first section, Lifestyles in the Golden Land, you've got some dreamers of the golden dream. That's the Lucille Miller story.
Yes, the suburban housewife in San Bernardino County, the murder case. Didion uses this really local, almost lurid story to dissect the whole myth of the California dream.
How so? It's not just about the crime itself.
No, not at all. She presents Lucille Miller as almost a product of the dream's pressure. The perfect house, the upward mobility, the constant need to keep up appearances. But underneath, financial strain, maybe boredom, a huge gap between the fantasy and the reality.
And that gap becomes unbearable.
It leads to this desperate act. Didion frames it as a consequence of believing too hard in this impossible promise of reinvention, this shiny surface with nothing solid underneath. It's the dark side of the dream.
Wow. Okay, so not just a crime story, but a cultural critique. Then the title essay, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, about Haight-Ashbury in 67, the summer of love.
Right, and this is where Didion really disturbed people at the time because she refused to buy into the whole flower power romance. She went there expecting, well, whatever the hype was, liberation, peace.
And she found?
Confusion, mostly. Aimlessness, exploitation, even. Kids who seemed completely lost. adrift from any kind of structure or guidance. Runaways.
And that unforgettable, chilling detail. The 5-year-old girl.
Yeah. High on acid. Given it by her parents, presumably. For Didion, that image was the ultimate symbol of what happens when all authority, all structure is rejected in the name of freedom.
The most vulnerable pay the price.
Irrevocably. It's the human cost of that anarchy loosed upon the world Yeats wrote about. It makes you question the romantic narrative of just tearing everything down.
It does, though you could ask, was she maybe a bit too focused on the negative, ignoring the genuine search for change?
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
Some critics felt she was too dismissive of the idealism, maybe unfairly cynical. She definitely contrasts the chaos she sees with older, fading symbols, like in the essay John Wayne, A Love Song.
Ah, John Wayne, the symbol of what? Rugged individualism?
Yeah.
Clear good guys and bad guys.
Exactly. That sort of uncomplicated black and white moral certainty. The old center, now looking obsolete.
And she contrasts him with someone like Joan Baez.
Yeah, Baez and her Institute for the Study of Nonviolence. Didion seemed to see that as a new kind of moralizing, but one that was too abstract, too detached from, you know, the messiness of real life. Well-intentioned, sure, but ultimately ineffective against the chaos. Old myths didn't work, but the new ideals felt flimsy, too.
But it's not all bleak external observation. There's an internal anchor she offers, right? On self-respect.
Yes. This essay is crucial. It's almost the counterweight to all the external disintegration. And she makes this brilliant distinction, still so relevant.
Between self-respect and self-esteem.
Exactly. Self-esteem, she suggests, relies on external validation. What do other people think? Am I liked? Self-respect, though, that's internal. It's discipline. A private code.
Like character. Keeping promises to yourself.
Precisely. It's about knowing your own worth, independent of applause. That's the only stable center you can really build for yourself, especially when the external world feels like it's falling apart. It's deeply pragmatic.
A private ethic for chaotic times.
Mm-hmm. And she makes this theme personal in Goodbye to All That, about leaving New York.
Which isn't just about New York, is it? It feels bigger.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor for growing up, for shedding those youthful illusions we all have, that feeling that life is going to be this grand, romantic story, that you are special, somehow exempt from the hard stuff.
And then reality hits.
Right. The slow, often painful realization that life is complicated, choices have consequences, things aren't always fair or neat. You lose that sense of immunity, that universal experience, that loss of innocence.
Okay, so if we pull back and look at the big picture, what are the core messages here? First, obviously, this collapse of the center and atomization.
Yeah, that's the main thread. When the shared connections fray, individuals get isolated. They become atoms floating free, which sounds like freedom, but Didion argues it leads to a loss of connection, which is fundamental.
Like that quote, not the absence of restrictions, but the absence of connections. Freedom becomes loneliness.
Exactly. Then the second theme, the illusion of the California dream. California as this big metaphor for the American promise. Come west, reinvent yourself, find success. But Didion just peels back the shiny surface.
Shows the hollowness, the potential for destruction underneath.
Mm-hmm. And third, something really sharp. The commodification of rebellion. How quickly the counterculture's gestures of dissent, its style, got absorbed and sold right back by the commercial system it was supposedly rejecting.
Rebellion as a brand, we still see that everywhere.
Absolutely. And finally, looping back to that essay, the fourth key idea, the importance of a personal ethic. In the absence of reliable external rules, you have to build your own internal code, that self-respect thing.
A pragmatic, almost survival-based morality.
Yeah, based on keeping promises to yourself, taking responsibility.
Her writing style makes these ideas stick, too, those specific concrete details she uses.
Oh, definitely. Like that opening line about the center not holding, followed immediately by, it was a country of bankruptcy notices and public auction announcements.
Grounds the abstract idea in tangible chaos. And then she adds, and commonplace reports of casual killings and misplaced children and abandoned homes and vandals who misspelled even the 4-letter words they scrawled. It's so specific, almost grimly funny in its detail.
It makes the breakdown feel real, not just theoretical. And that line about atomization is just hauntingly relevant today. We are talking about something more general, some atomization that is ruining the promises of freedom, which proves to be not the absence of restrictions, but the absence of connections.
Hits right where we live now, doesn't it? And the antidote she offers, that internal strength, to have that sense of one's intrinsic worth, which constitutes self-respect, is potentially to have everything. A private reconciliation, a known fact, a tremor in the bone.
That tremor in the bone, such powerful phrasing for something so internal, so fundamental. So, okay, this was written about the 60s. How do we use these insights now? What are the real life applications?
Well, one big one seems to be developing critical media literacy. Her whole method, paying close attention to detail, noticing the gap between what's said and what's real, that's essential today.
Definitely. With all the narratives swirling around, polarized media, her approach trains you to look past the slogans, the official story, whatever it might be, and ask, what's really going on here? What are the human details?
Question everything, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the cultivating internal resilience piece, that self-respect versus self-esteem idea feels like a direct answer to, you know, the pressures of social media.
Oh, completely. Instead of chasing likes or external validation, focus on that internal compass, keeping promises to yourself, maintaining your own standards, regardless of the noise. It's about character, not just image.
It's practical advice for staying sane. And finally, the book helps in understanding fragmentation. It gives you a language, a framework for thinking about why things feel so divided now, why we retreat into tribes.
Right. Recognizing that the loss of a shared center isn't just a political problem, it has a real psychological impact. It helps explain some of the anxiety and anger we see.
So, final thoughts. What's the big takeaway for you from revisiting this?
For me, it's Didion's refusal to romanticize chaos. She insists that we look at the actual human cost of these big transformations. Social change isn't just abstract ideas. It affects real people, especially the vulnerable. We need to pay attention to that, not just the grand narratives.
Yeah, that sobriety is powerful. And for me, it's her enduring commitment to clear-eyed observation, her ability to link these huge cultural shifts down to the smallest, most personal details, a misspelled word, a child's vacant expression. That's what makes the diagnosis timeless. It's about the human condition when the ground shifts beneath our feet. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.